Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 19th of December. Today, the man who masterminded the 1994 genocide in Rwanda is jailed for life by a UN court.
Long before the genocide began in April 1994, he had been at the forefront of organising the militias.
Police apologise after a man with a history of violent attacks against women admits killing Rachel Nickell on Wimbledon Common 16 years ago.
It was on the front pages of every newspaper at the time, and therefore there was enormous pressure, I think, at the time for the police to try and find somebody very quickly.
And the psychology that allowed Bernie Madoff to get away with a multi-billion pound fraud.
If it's all based on a fraud, then someone needs to step in and stop it happening. And that's what the American regulators singularly failed to do.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines with Sandy Waugh.
Scotland Yard is rejecting calls for an inquiry into errors made when police investigated the killing of Rachel Nickell in 1992. Yesterday, Robert Knapper admitted manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Police apologised to Colin Stagg, wrongly accused of her murder in 1994. They said more could have been done to catch Knapper and prevent his further crimes, but instead the way murder is investigated has changed significantly. The Labour MP Keith Fowles has called for the police to review their procedures. More on the Rachel Nickell story coming up in Guardian Daily. A six-month ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip ends today. Hamas say they're not expecting the ceasefire to be renewed and that Israel failed to ease its blockade on the Gaza Strip. Israel has said it's in favour of renewing the truce. Both sides are accusing the other of regularly infringing the truce. The Pentagon's ordered plans to be drawn up for the closure of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. US President-elect Barack Obama says closing the camp in a responsible way is one of his top priorities and that he aims to close the facility within 2 years. About 250 detainees remain in the camp in Cuba. One in 10 English councils is seeing increased demand for school places as parents switch from private to state schools to save money, a report suggests. The Audit Commission's report into the effect of the credit crunch on councils shows an increasing demand for their services as well as a drop in income. The Commission's also found councils are receiving more applications for housing and other benefits as a direct result of the downturn. Japan's government has forecast that the country's economy will have zero growth in the year ending March 2010. It's the first projection from the government of no growth in 7 years. The Bank of Japan has cut its key interest rate to just 0.1%, taking it lower than US rates. This morning's papers now. Most of the papers carry front page pictures of Rachel Nickell or her killer, Robert Knapper. The Times leads with the fallout from the case and, in particular, the police errors which allowed Robert Knapper to kill again. The Independent runs the headline, A Death Foretold, saying that Robert Knapper's mother warned police in 1989 that her son was a danger to women. The Mail has two pictures of Robert Knapper, one as an angelic-looking child next to a picture of him as an adult with the headline, The Boy Who Grew Up to Kill Rachel. Accompanying the Rachel Nickell story on the front page of The Guardian is a picture of skulls from some of those massacred in the Rwanda genocide. The man accused of masterminding the 1994 genocide, Theoneste Bagosora, was jailed for life by an international court yesterday. More on this in Guardian Daily. The Financial Times focuses on the fall of the pound. Sterling nears euro parity, it says, following the pound's ninth consecutive fall against the euro. The Express says banks are punishing savers following successive interest rate cuts. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Rwanda's former defence chief of staff has been jailed for life for masterminding genocide in 1994. Theoneste Bagosora had denied directing the massacre of 800,000 people by Hutu militia. Two senior army officers also received life sentences for genocide. Prosecutors at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, sitting in Tanzania, hailed the verdict as the most significant of its kind since Nuremberg. Our Africa editor, Chris McGreal, reported from Rwanda in 1994 for The Guardian. Chris, what was Theoneste Bagosora's role in the Rwandan genocide?
he was a former colonel who was the chief of staff in the defense ministry and a well-known Hutu extremist. And essentially, long before the genocide began in April 1994, he had been at the forefront of organizing the militias that would later lead to the killing, at basically bringing together Hutu extremists and starting the vilification of the Tutsi minority in a way that hadn't been heard since the early days of independence. Bagosora organized the Interahamwe militia, which he armed misusing his position inside the defense ministry. He personally opposed any kind of negotiated settlement with the Tutsi rebels who had invaded from Rwanda, from Uganda. And when a deal was finally in place and it looked like there was going to be a power-sharing government with those Tutsi rebels, Bagosora was behind the assassination of Rwanda's president, Habyarimana, and that was the event that kicked off the genocide.
A UN commander in Rwanda described meeting Bagosora at the start of the genocide as being like shaking hands with the devil.
Yes, indeed. Romeo Dallaire was a Canadian lieutenant general who was in charge of the UN peacekeepers there. And in the very first hours of the killing, he went to a meeting with Bagosora. He had thought that at that point, the people being killed were mostly Hutu moderates inside the government. And Dallaire had gone thinking that he could appeal to Bagosora to put a stop to it. At the meeting, Dallaire quickly discovered that actually Bagosora was planning to take power. And Dallaire made the point that although the president was dead, there was still a civilian government in place led by a prime minister, a woman prime minister, and that and that Bagosora had no business taking power. Within hours, the prime minister had been raped and murdered, and moderates inside the cabinet had also been killed, and Bagosora installed his own government. And at that point, Dallaire realized that Bagosora was behind the killing. He also organized the murders of 10 UN Belgian peacekeepers. They were brutally tortured and murdered over several hours, and that was intended to drive out the UN peacekeeping force, and it had exactly the desired effect. The UN Security Council then voted to pull out, and Dallaire was left with a tiny force, largely unable to stop the killing.
What's the significance of this verdict?
Well, I think the most important thing of it is that it is the first verdict that very clearly establishes that there was an organized genocide. Their previous verdicts were important people, including regional governors and, in fact, the prime minister, who was appointed after the death of the former prime minister who was murdered, did establish that there had been some organization, but this trial was about it being centrally controlled, about the genocide not being spontaneous. And I think that for many years, Bagosora and others, including their defense lawyers, but many sympathizers outside, have argued that the genocide wasn't organized, it was a spontaneous reaction, and that in many ways the victims brought this on themselves just by being Tutsis and there being Tutsi rebels who were fighting inside the country. I think this verdict establishes that this is not the case, that this was an organized genocide. And then it also, as one of the prosecutors said to me, it is an important verdict because it's there now in black and white, in transcripts and videotapes, laying out just how the genocide was planned and organised, and nobody can now deny that.
Chris McGreal, many thanks. And there's full coverage of that story today at guardian.co.uk/Rwanda. Also on The Guardian's website, to celebrate Barbie's 50th birthday, two feminists argue for and against her existence. Guardian.co.uk/women. Dave Hill says that Boris Johnson's idea of elected politicians running the police authority is a good idea. Guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say on that. And you can follow England's second test in India with our live over-by-over report. Guardian.co.uk/sport/cricket. In July 1992, 23-year-old model Rachel Nickell was sexually assaulted and murdered in a frenzied knife attack in broad daylight on Wimbledon Common in South London. Her 2-year-old son Alex was found clinging to her, covered in her blood. The public horror at Rachel Nickell's murder prompted a frantic hunt for her killer, resulting in the prosecution of an innocent man, Colin Stagg. The judge threw out the case before it reached a jury. He condemned the prosecution for relying on a psychological profile of Stagg and for using an undercover policewoman to try and get Stagg to admit the killing. Yesterday at the Old Bailey, Robert Napper, a 42-year-old with a history of mental illness and violent attacks on young women, pleaded guilty to the killing. Duncan Campbell has the story.
It was particularly horrifying, partly because the child of Rachel Nicol was one of the was the only witness apart from the murderer. It also helped in terms of the coverage it got that she was very beautiful and that it was on Wimbledon Common in broad daylight. And it was on the front pages of every newspaper at the time, and therefore there was enormous pressure, I think, at the time for the police to try and find somebody very quickly.
When they did find someone, it was the wrong man, Colin Stagg.
They found a lot of people. There were 13 arrests in the first month, and eventually Colin Stagg, who I think was the 27th person that they picked up, when he was charged, the feeling was, as far as the police were concerned, that they had found the right man, and I think that was reflected in some of the coverage in the media at the time. And it wasn't until it came to his trial at the Old Bailey, which was thrown out before it reached a jury, that the case started to unravel and it became clear that there was actually very little real evidence against him.
The evidence, such as it was based on psychological profiling, which was a kind of fashionable police technique of the time, wasn't it?
It was. It coincided with the television series Cracker, which came out in, I think, first of all in 93, and this was before his trial in 94, when it was thought that by a number of different actions of a person and the way the kind of stuff they read, the way they behaved, they would fit a profile of somebody who could commit a crime like that. And based partly on that and the advice the police got from their police profiler, Stagg was arrested, and what wasn't clear at the time was that there was very little other real evidence. There was no DNA, there was no witnesses, there was no fingerprints, there was no blood found in his place. It was all highly, highly circumstantial, and I think lots of lessons have now been learned.
And they used an undercover policewoman to try and entice Stagg into making a confession, which he didn't do.
Yes, this was again on the advice of the psychological profiler, and the officer concerned was very brave because she thought at the time that she was putting herself at the mercy of a murderer, and so I think there's a lot of respect for the fact that she was prepared to do that. But it became clear from the dialogue recorded between them that even although she had said it would be exciting if he was the murderer of Rachel Nicol, even then he denied it, and he's denied it before that and ever since, and finally he has his formal vindication this week.
How did the police miss the clues that allowed Robert Napper to evade justice for such a long time?
Well, it's easy with hindsight to suggest that they should have picked up on more things, but there are certainly some that even allowing for that 2020 hindsight vision, that do seem amazing. On one occasion, he admitted to his mother that he'd carried out a rape. His mother called the police. They hadn't had the report of a rape in that area, so they didn't go round to see him. Had they gone round to see him, taken a DNA sample, when other rapes and another murder in which he was involved in came to light, and DNA from the Nicol case came to light, that they would have had their man. But they would have actually had him before the Nicol murder ever took place. So that was one aspect. And the other aspect is that at the same time, he was up more or less simultaneously with Stagg on a separate murder. And the police did not join the dots up on that occasion and think, hang on a minute, these are two very similar styles of murder in the same sort of area. Maybe we should swallow our pride and look at Napper as the possible killer of Rachel Nicol. And I think that was another grave error. And to be fair to the Metropolitan Police, they have now acknowledged those errors and finally have apologised. And Colin Stagg, again, I think quite admirably, has said that he doesn't blame the detectives. They weren't corrupt. They thought they were going after the right person. But he is angry that he didn't get an apology from the top of Scotland Yard, that he didn't get an apology from the prosecution services, and that he didn't get an apology from the psychological profiler who had kind of put him there in the first place.
Duncan Campbell. I'm John Dennis. You're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come, John Henley investigates the pension system and finds it wanting.
Who could possibly have imagined that it was wise to entrust money that was that important to the stock market?
But first, Bernard Madoff was one of Wall Street's most respected financiers. His annual returns were 10 to 12%, even when the rest of the market was falling. He was beyond suspicion, a position that he exploited to defraud his wealthy investors of billions of dollars. Ed Pilkington explains how Madoff's scheme worked.
Well, over a period of time, no one knows exactly how long, but it could have been decades. He ran what's called a Ponzi scheme, which is essentially a sort of pretty basic pyramid scam where he took in investments from increasingly rich clients and he just sort of moved the money around in a circle. He used the incoming money to pay returns or alleged profits on the investments of earlier clients, and he'd just keep moving the money around. The problem with any scheme like that is that when the money stops coming in his case, as a result of the credit crunch a few months ago, the whole thing collapses and there's nothing in the middle of it. And he is said to have told investigators that it was all a big lie and it was built on thin air.
I mean, he fooled not only the regulators for so many years, but also some big name investors. How did he get away with it for so long?
Yeah, I mean, the two, I think, central mysteries about this whole event is, one, how he managed to fool people for so long, and two, almost more interestingly, why major investors gave 100% of their money. I mean, the entire lump sum that they had to invest to him, which is kind of very unusual. Most people will split their investments, and they might put it some of it into a risky holding, but some of it into government stocks or something that's very dependable. In his case, he managed to fool people into trusting him so much that they gave him their entire life's worth. And that's partly why it's so devastating. There are thousands of people in America, particularly down in Florida and in Long Island, and indeed around the world, who have lost their whole life stock, their whole life savings, often their pensioners who were, you know, retiring on this money, and they've lost everything. So it's a very, very emotionally sort of fraught event, this. And the question now for regulators is, how did they manage to miss it for so long? And also, what was it about this man that made people so trusting in him?
What do you think they might come up with in the answer to that latter question, Ed?
Well, the US regulators have a lot of big questions to answer about how they missed it. I mean, apparently they were warned about it many years ago, as early as 1999, and maybe even earlier than that. There are suggestions that there may have been relationships involved between people who worked for Madoff and officials within the regulating body, and they'll have to look into that. But on the other side, in terms of the trust, I mean, this guy was a very, very big figure in Wall Street. So I think there was a combination going on of people, you know, not questioning him, because how can you question someone with such an extraordinarily upright and respectable track record? And also, I suspect there was an element of people not asking awkward questions because they were doing quite well, handsomely out of this, thank you very much. I mean, anyone involved in Madoff was making a lot of money themselves. They were getting very steady, relatively high returns at a time when other investors may be suffering from a declining stock market. So it suited people not to ask awkward questions. And I think that was also part of the psychology of this enormous scam.
I mean, people do seem to just believe what they want to believe when it comes to investments when they're going well.
Yes, and of course, that's when regulation should kick in, because regulators are there to protect people from their own worst sort of emotions. You know, if things are going well, why question anything? Well, if it's all based on a fraud, then someone needs to step in and stop it happening. And that's what the American regulators singularly failed to do. And the other part of the psychology, I think, was not only, you know, you don't tend to question things when things are going well, people are actually scrambling to try and get on board. increasingly, as time went on, he was seen as a most desirable place to invest your money. And there was a huge queue of people lining up to be with him. He maintained a sort of slightly elusive figure in all this. And so there was an element of hunger. People wanted to be seen with him. They wanted to be in with him. They wanted their money to be with his trust. And the more that he resisted people investing with him, the more people wanted to invest with him. So there's an interesting psychology there too.
Ed Pilkington, and you can read Ed's feature on Bernie Madoff tomorrow at guardian.co.uk/business. Next month, the state pension will be 100 years old. Since 1909, responsibility has shifted from state to company and then from company to individual. The Guardian's John Henley says the UK's pension system is now one of the worst in the world. It's geared towards making money for the financial services sector at the expense of the individual.
I started looking into it a little bit in the wake of the latest stock market crash, really, when you know everybody was saying, "Oh, blimey, the FTSE has lost sort of 28%, 27%, or whatever." And I think, like a lot of people, I went through a long stage in my life of thinking, you know, that actually worrying about your pension was, you know, a sure sign of a very boring person, and I really didn't bother. And then I went through a stage of thinking, well, actually, maybe this is a little bit more important than I thought it was, and I should take an interest, but I was frankly too scared to do so. And then finally, I got around to it. I thought, well, really, I'd better have a look at it now. And I discovered, you know, I suppose not to my great surprise, but certainly to my horror, my pension pot too had lost something like 30% of its value over the last 12 months. And that kind of really got me thinking, really, and I started digging around. And it is it's a very sad thing that pensions just turn people off. But it is sad because, I mean, I think it is actually incontestable that Britain has really one of the worst pension systems in the developed world. I can't imagine how it's possible to get much worse. We have, at one and the same time, we have the lowest state pension in Europe. You know, at the moment it's about 97 quid a week. With a bit of luck, you might get that boosted to about 124. That's your state pension. To qualify for that, you have to have very few savings, and you have to have contributed your national insurance through all the working years of your life. It is so low. Our state pension is so low, partly because Margaret Thatcher, in one of her first moves coming to power, she sort of de-linked it from wages. And coupled it instead to inflation, which means it's probably lost about 50% of its value over the last 30-odd years. So on the one hand, we have the lowest state pension in Europe. And on the other hand, I mean, that didn't really matter. When Thatcher did that 30 years ago, nobody really kicked up a fuss, because at that stage, we all had, or most of us, a very, very large number of us, had, you know, reasonably generous company schemes, these kind of salary pension schemes, which paid you a guaranteed percentage of your, you know, of your salary over your years in work. Those, because we're all living so much longer, a phenomenal amount longer now, companies started phasing those out at, you know, relatively recently, over the last 10, 15 years or so. And only 15% of us are actually now in a generous guaranteed final salary pension scheme. The rest of us are in these what's called defined contribution schemes, which invest in the stock market. I mean, if in effect, what's happened is basically, you know, pensions in Britain have been privatized. And so, you know, we invest in, we put our retirement savings, you know, which is the money that we're going to need when we've got no chance of earning any other kind of money, we happily pass it on to these middlemen who make a fortune out of investing it on the stock market for us. I mean, who could possibly have imagined that it was wise to entrust money that was that important to the stock market? So on one hand, you know, these guys, they make a fortune out of it. And on the other hand, we're left to the vagaries of the stock market, with the, as a result of which I and you and probably a lot of other people have lost, you know, up to a third of the value of their pension pot. And even if we do succeed in saving a lot, you know, quite a lot of money, it's going to give us absolutely a pitiful income at the end of it. The average amount that the average British working person saves into a one of these defined contribution schemes is something like £25,000 to £30,000, John, which is going to give us at the current rate an annual retirement income. This is annual, not monthly, an annual retirement income of about £1,500.
John Henley. Football league clubs will have to include 4 homegrown players in every 16-man squad. Chairman of the 72 clubs voted for the rule at an extraordinary general meeting. It'll come into effect at the start of next season. With the detail is our chief football writer, Kevin McKerra.
I think the rule really fundamentally shows you the different nature of the leagues outside the Premier League and the ways in which they've forged their own identity. This initiative means that you must have 4 players in your squad who have come through your youth system, your first team squad. And that, however, does not necessarily mean that they are English, because, of course, as Arsenal have proved, raiding other people's youth academies and bringing in kids from overseas is a very productive route to take. But it does put a certain emphasis on youth development and not buying success or trying to buy success. We all remember years ago when ITV Digital went bust and the disaster that was to clubs in the lower division. I think they've been trying to find a more sustainable way of preserving themselves in football since then, and this fits in well with that.
What problem does this seek to address?
Basically providing opportunities, trying to get clubs weaned off the old pro sort of idea of people who've always been knocking about or somebody got in a free transfer. This puts a premium on your youth development people bringing through players of the requisite standard. It's not just a nice thing to do. It does show... It's not critical, 4's all right, it's not a majority, but it's still a noteworthy element of a squad that has been produced and directed by your own coaches, and that puts them under an obligation to reach a higher level.
What difference will it make in the long run, do you think?
I think it's an effect at the margins, but one of the things it might do is, of course, raise the value of really good youth coaches. If somebody can bring 4 people into your first team squad, aren't just making up the numbers, but adding value to your club, then those coaches themselves become significant. They aren't just blokes in the background, they are key to your prospects.
Will the Premier League follow suit, do you think?
I think the Premier League will fight tooth and nail against any sorts of restrictions. They have a very much a sort of free market philosophy, you know, just let the market rip. And if you talk to chief executive Richard Scudamore, would tell you that unashamedly. I don't see it happening. I think you pointed some sort of a financial crisis which made clubs feel they had to explore something other than the transfer market. Now, football finance does have some difficulties, but I don't think it's anywhere near the situation that we saw with the Championship and Leagues 1 and 2.
Kevin McKerra. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta at The Guardian's new headquarters in King's Cross by Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.